And you're very welcome to the podcast for this Friday. Another interesting show. Of course, it being Friday, the Friday panel is coming up. I'll get to some of your comments following those conversations that we just didn't get time to on the show. What else is coming up? Donna Marie Doherty is an interesting package about prison life in McGilligan Prison. We speak to Donna Harper following the council's decision to grant planning permission for a, I suppose you could call it, a service station and shop in the village. Obviously, there are different views in that area, and we'll hear all of those. That and so much more besides. But just to some of the comments that we didn't get through. And during our conversation with the Friday panel, of course, we were going to talk about the tragedy of last weekend where a lady from Derry, Amy Doherty, became the 30th woman since 2000 to be murdered. We were talking about women's safety. A caller said, "Good morning, Greg. Are men and women not being taught to be respectful of women and of others? It begins at home by the parents not only teaching the birds and the bees, but in how we not only be respectful to yourself, but also to the opposite sex and to everyone you meet." Yeah, indeed, that would be the ideal situation, but often it's not like that, is it? Read domestic violence, said another listener. Violence towards women starts, stats from Holland claim that lesbian relationships can be the most volatile, but shush, don't mention that, doesn't fit the narrative. Well, there is no narrative, and there's certainly no narrative on the Greg Hughes Show with those statistics and that information is out there. More than happy to have a conversation about that as well. Another, "Good morning, Greg. One of your Friday panel talks about Ashley Murphy. Could you talk about the left's disgusting attacks on her boyfriend? These people should be ashamed." And that obviously is a situation that then moved into the space of immigration and migration and what have you. And I think that that's what that caller was referencing there. Another caller was talking about the government and indeed the media, and they claimed that the government and media have normalised incompetence and corruption. Pascal Donoghue, they said, joined the World Bank after being finance minister and gave them an extra 10 million beyond what they were looking for. We have just accepted these things. Well, I think really maybe you have, speaking to this listener, because we talked about that extensively and had a lot of reaction to it, and then it just falls away after a day or two, and the public, as much as the media or the government, move on. Greg, I was at a service station this morning and the diesel hasn't been taken down because they're waiting on a new delivery, but it went up as soon as the first rocket landed in Iran. It's not sustainable for motorists, and of course it depends on what drove the price up versus how it's being brought down. One, it's instant, and the other, it's when you get a new stock in. Lots of you all week talking about fuel prices, and we talked to the Friday panel about that as well. "I was in a petrol station," said a listener yesterday, "after being away for a few weeks. I was shocked by the prices. When I inquired about them, I realised that the prices had only come down by 8 cents and not 20 cents. How are the government allowed to fleece us? This is wrong." But this was always the problem, wasn't it, listeners? The prices were going up as the government was trying to bring them down. Another said, "I was at a petrol station this morning and the fuel prices only came down by 8 cents. How can this be?" And on it goes. Of course, the big soccer game on Thursday night, the big football game, Ireland fell short. It was a frustrating game, wasn't it? Ireland dominated the first half. Could have been more than 2-0 up. We gave away a soft penalty. Second half, it was all Czechia. First half of extra time, all Czechia. Then we seemed to have chances in the second half of extra time. But the way the team was set up, we were set up to be on the break, I felt, watching it. But we didn't have the ability on the pitch to break, so to speak. And when you've got a brilliant player like Troy Parrott having to fall so deep to try and pick up the ball, it's tough. And it's always tough to go out on penalties. But a listener said, "At least now we don't have to make a decision about even participating in the World Cup." And I think part of that is Israel's involvement. And one last one on this. "Thank God I got the GEA. That game last night was a disaster." Okay, right. Don't forget, we're back with a brand new live show for you on Monday morning at 9 a.m. This podcast available for you around about 11:30 every weekday. And don't forget, we have the sister podcast, the Greg Hughes podcast, released on a Friday afternoon at 11 o'clock. I'll talk to you live real soon. Stay tuned. Here's today's podcast.
The Talk of the Northwest, the Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the Greg Hughes Show here for this Friday, the 27th of March. It's 5 minutes past nine. I do hope you're all very well indeed. It's good to have you on board. We've a bumper couple of hours for you. The first hour dedicated to our Friday panel. We're going to be talking about some of the big issues of the day and the week, of course. If you want to get involved in the conversation, and we encourage you to do so, you can WhatsApp and text us on 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. Give us a call on 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. Let's say good morning to India Kennedy, Campaigns and Events Director with OGRA, Fianna Fáil. Good morning to you. How are you keeping?
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we have a radio running in the background. I'm not sure who's got that going, but is that you, John?
I must check.
Caroline Sweeney, President of Letterkenny Chamber. How are you, Caroline?
I'm very well. Greg, how are you this morning?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us. And you got a sneak preview of John McAteer. He loves Highland Radio so much, he listens to it whilst actually also being a guest on it at the same time. Hi, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Good to have you back on the programme. India, I'll start with you, if that's all right. The government's emergency fuel package cut petrol by 17 cent, diesel by 22 cent, alongside an enhanced diesel rebate scheme for hauliers. However, with private commuters facing well in excess of 2 litre at the pumps, hauliers warning of supply chain inflation on groceries, and farmers only getting a 3 cent cut in green diesel, did this package do enough to protect the backbone of our rural economy and the commercial economy generally, or was it a piecemeal attempt to appease too many different sectors all at the one time? What do you think?
I think, Greg, that it's a good start. I think that it's an emergency measure made during an emergency situation. I think that there is specific reliefs targeted at hauliers, buses and coach operators, farmers, but I don't think there's enough done just yet. I'd like to think that this is a start and not an end to it. I'd like to see more supports made available, especially for those that rely heavily on the fuels, taxi drivers, hauliers. I also think there needs to be a rebate for fishermen, because nothing has been mentioned for them at the minute, and they still have to pay extortionate costs for diesel. And at the moment, is their time now to be out fishing? So they need a further relief. But you'd like to see a lot more. You'd like to see a lot more of the prices coming down, because at the minute it's just unworkable.
Yeah, but we don't really have time to wait for this to be the start and what might come next.
Absolutely, Greg. I agree with you on that one. I think it needs to be immediate. I think it's a start, but it's not good enough at the minute. I think more funding needs to be made available.
Why do you think then they didn't do it when they had the opportunity, you know, to try and make things easier for people just right now?
I think they were trying to respond immediately to the price gouge, and I would say that they probably did it with a hope that businesses would match and bring down the diesel prices themselves, but that's not the case at the minute. But we'll have to see for the next few weeks how it fares out, whether the international prices will come down, but hopefully they will. If not, there needs to be more funding made available for it.
Yeah, indeed. Caroline Sweeney, President of Letterkenny Chamber. You know, I know there are companies, businesses, part of your chamber group now that are receiving consignments, and they have, you know, this additional cost on them, and they're having to pay that additional cost. It's eventually going to have to go on to the consumer, you'd imagine, that on top of the rising cost of everything else. What sentiment like do you think, and what's your mark for the government's intervention here?
Well, a couple of different comments, Greg. Obviously, speaking from the first and foremost from the Chamber's point of view, representing our members, and having actually spoke to our members throughout the week across different sectors, and having certain feedback from our other board members, there's a lot of chatter locally on a local level. People are very concerned. And although we acknowledge the government's interventions and that they do provide relief to certain sectors, there still is some uncertainty and unclarity for various sectors across the board. And as you know, Greg, we have members from all across different sectors. And I suppose even coming from my own job, the amount of people that I have spoke to over the weekend, coming from all backgrounds, including farming, guests here at Castle Grove, there's definitely a level of disappointment, I would say, in the government's relief plan. And, you know, you mentioned there to India, do you think did they act quick enough? I think we have to acknowledge the government's actions. I do think we have to understand that they just can't pull a cash lever. You know, it is a crisis. They are trying to find a balance, but I do think action needs to happen. And there definitely is concern and disappointment. And it's not just the immediate effect on the fuel, which is obviously the first sector targeted, but it's the knock-on effect. And as you mentioned earlier in your show, just before we came on, they were talking briefly about the farming community and fertilizer. I mean, that ultimately affects the food supply, which is a basic need. So, and also to be mindful that all these people who are running businesses and are trying to deal with these challenges and stresses, including myself, I mean, our oil bill at the moment is unsustainable. And regardless if the weather, you know, improves outside, we still have to have heat in the hotel. We still have to heat the water. So it's definitely very concerning. And just to add, all those people have to go home and run households. So the real people behind these businesses that have to go home then and try and manage these stresses at home as well. So I understand, my message would be, I understand the government is in a crisis. We are in a crisis. I don't think it's going away anytime soon. I do think more action is needed. And I do think there's a balance is required.
Yeah, but do we also have to be realistic and say such is the global impact of this? There's only so much any state can actually do to offset what we're talking about here, because I have a strong suspicion the worst of the oil price increases have not yet flushed through to start affecting us in any real sense.
I would agree with that, absolutely. And that's what I was sort of alluding to, even the simple fact of the food. I mean, I was listening to an expert the other day and they said, you know, we mightn't see that impact for 2 to 3 months. Now we are at the end of week 5 in this situation, in this crisis. So, I do think there's going to be more knock-on effects. I do agree with you. That's what I sort of was referring to in the balance. There is an element where it's out of our control or out of the government's control. They're not responsible for that war. However, it is their responsibility to the citizens of Ireland to sort of put these relief packages in place, not only for the average household, but also for the business community, which is the backbone of our national economy. And it's critical.
John McAteer, what do you think?
More or less what I was saying on Wednesday, except there's much more evidence there. Now, it was never going to come down 20 cents a litre, because as far back as last Friday, the wholesalers were signalling increases. On Monday and Tuesday, they were offering the four-course diesel at an increase of 19 cents a litre. It hasn't turned out to be quite that bad. I've been checking around last night and this morning. In some places, it's down 10 cents, and that's going to be the height of it. It's expected to go back up next week again. And the 20 cents will be eroded by Easter, I would imagine. Some of it is... It just depends where you get your fuel. It depends on what you can store. It's all of these things, and it depends when you last got your supply. That was a very poor effort, regardless of how you look at it, because the government knew more than anybody else that fuel is going up almost on a daily basis on a highly volatile global trading market. And the war is not showing any end at all in sight. It could be there for another month, another 2 months, but it could take another 6 to 8 months before things begin to come back to normal. The government's intervention will be eroded. Where do we go then? Why did they not cut VAT by 4 or 5% and see how that went on a temporary basis? Because like that's 20 cents.
Yeah, but eventually, as you say, though, I mean, you're saying that you want everything front-loaded, but the correct way to handle public finances, would it not be, John, to see how things progress? It is such a volatile and fluid situation. You don't want to throw everything you have at it, do you? Because you don't know how long this might go on for, and then you introduce these sweeping changes you talk of. That's a public expectation then. You can't withdraw it. This could run on, as you say yourself, for many, many months or years. And then what does the government do? It starts saying, well, the exchequer's taking a hit. This is locked in. And, we're banjaxed.
We're not banjaxed, no. We have a decent amount of money in the exchequer over the next 6 months, a year. 250 million of an intervention was literally peanuts, because there are huge sectors of society who are not benefiting from it at all. Farmers, as you mentioned earlier on, are at the pin of their collar, and there's still 500,000 tonnes of fertiliser to be brought into the country. We don't have it. The prices, first of all, we don't know how it's going to get here. Secondly, it's going to go up in price.
I really hope, by the way, and I'd be interested in any farmers' comments in relation to this. I really hope fertiliser is not being stored now
to be sold down the line at a higher price, even though it was bought in at a lower price, because that would just be an insult to injury for the farming community. But I'm sure it's not happening.
We don't actually have much detail about that, but what we do understand is that fuel, there is no price gouging proven. It's not happening. It's the volatility of the international markets on which our fuel purchasers are based. And, you know, the forecourts are already subsidising by a couple of cents. They're very little out of it. They've about less than 4%. The suppliers have about 34% or thereabouts. They're subsidising it by 8 cents. So you can see where it should be at. You
know. Caroline, in your head, as a business person, what are you allowing for, if you know what I mean, in terms of these elevated costs? Because, you know, I, I can sort of maybe optimistically say it's kind of interesting now, because Trump's claims of progress are no longer affecting oil markets. They've given up on even listening to them now. So words aren't making any difference. But I'd be hoping as a consumer that my diesel might come down to 193. I'd do cartwheels for that. But I'm thinking about a tank of petrol a week and a tank of oil a week. From a business perspective, in your mind, are you locking in sort of a minimum as what you might have to endure?
Absolutely. Just speaking again from myself as a business owner here at Castle Grove, we have had our meetings around how we're going to manage what oil is required based on the capacity that we're operating at and coming in. Obviously, it is coming into better weather, but at the same time, we have to sit down week to week and figure out, okay, we need X amount of money for heating and hot water, and what do we need? Where can that money come from? We can't change the prices. So is it a case that we need an extra 20 people in the restaurant, or do we need to fill more rooms? Or of course we're thinking about that, because it's not sustainable. It's just not sustainable. And we cannot put that cost on the guest at the moment. We just cannot. I mean, it's too short of a period at the moment. We're only 5 weeks in. I agree with you a little bit that we do need to sort of watch this and monitor it. And we, you know, as part of being a business owner, you have to be prepared for these situations. They will come and go, and we have to manage. We have to, you know, make sure that we come out the other side. And we have to, of course, we have to think about it and figure it out. But at the meantime, that's what we're doing. We're just going week to week and monitoring and hoping. But we are thinking down. And I will think one thing I would say is that we obviously have been looking at other energy resources. And this is just a stark reminder of how we should not be relying solely on oil, because in overnight, the situation went from 980 euro for 1,000 litres to 1,540 within 2 days. And then it went to 1,840, then it went to 1,980. Yesterday it was back to 1,680 for 1,000 litres. So, I mean, there are significant jumps within 1 week period. So, absolutely.
And then you sort of would be looking at, well, I certainly would be looking at, it's like this now, how much progress and how much improvement can we see before what month in the year you have to start cranking the heating up again and to put the lights on from 4?
It's not just even the heating, Greg. It's a simple thing. Even the food, I mentioned the food. I mean, everything that's coming in the back door, there's a surcharge on it, because everything has to be delivered. Everything's coming in lorries. Even local stuff, it still has to be transported here. So I'm quite worried about that as well. The supply chain and what impact that's going to have on food coming in. And, you know, all over the years and the different crises and different sort of recessions and problems that we've had in our economy, you know, we've tried to hold the prices. We firmly believe that if you hold the prices, the guests will come when they can. And if you can ride the storm, you'll come out better in the end. So and thankfully, you know, we're in a position that we can try to manage that situation. But I would be worried about businesses who do not have the cash flow to manage that situation. And, you know, I'm very, very, very passionate about that particularly the businesses in Letterkenny, 60 to 70% of our members are small to medium businesses. And they just make, you know, we have to be mindful of that. And as John mentioned earlier, it's across all sectors. There's so many sectors involved here in business, particularly in Donegal. And that's what we're on today, talking about our business primarily here in Donegal. And that's our role to sort of speak on their behalf.
Go ahead, John.
We really haven't seen any of it as yet. Just out and about last night checking up prices, and you see the odd notice appearing for the consumers warning of certain price increases in services as a consequence of the fuel increases. So that's the very tip of the iceberg. You know, if you're going to be paying more for transport, paying more for the removal of your waste products and all of these kind of things, because these are all being removed by trucks.
Mm.
Burning an awful lot of diesel. So it'll be after Easter before we see or get any real handle on.
And then even something like the taxi industry. You know, I mean, look at the taxi industry, yeah.
It affects every industry. It affects, and nobody's talking much about this, construction's being really, really hammered into the ground because they're using pretty heavy-duty equipment, that some of those machines are burning 1,000 litres of fuel a day. And so it is with the farm contractors, you know. I mean, they can't make up that money.
Mm.
A few cents here, a few cents there. The government haven't factored in, as Mary says there. You have to factor in and project what the costs are going to be further down the road. The only thing that you can see, it's going to affect everybody in the hotel industry the very same, regardless of where you live.
It's the transportation, be it within the state or outside the state, of everything. We import an awful lot of stuff, from a pair of shoes, then the obviously manufacturing of food and all of that. Caroline?
Yeah, and just to mention as well, particularly the hospitality sector, I can speak from, obviously we're depending on guests to come here. And there's at Mayhill there the other day, there definitely is some concern around, obviously we have to be positive, but there's definitely concern about how many guests are going to be travelling into the country as well, visitors. So that impacts everybody as well.
There are people who have who scrape by, and they can spend less. But then there comes a cohort of people that starts wondering how long this might last, and they have some resources, but they start spending less. And that's, you know, that feels very recession-y to me. India, I don't want to be an armchair general, but let's go. I don't know why Israel and the US did what they did when they did. B, I don't know what they're trying to achieve or how you can... actually frame it as what has been achieved, and see, I really can't see how particularly the United States get out of this. Iran, as far as I can see at this moment, seem to hold all the cards, and it's very hard to see how this concludes.
I agree with you completely on that one, Greg. It's such a difficult topic. It's such a difficult situation. But the knock-on effect that it's having across the board, it's unparalleled. I mean, obviously, you're completely correct in your analysis that Israel hold all the cards. They absolutely do. Every morning on the radio, you can hear Trump saying this and Trump saying that and Trump saying the other. And he was so confident, overly confident at the start. And now he's realizing actually he doesn't hold all the cards. And this could go on for months. It could go on for years. And you'd like to hope that it won't. But I mean, something needs to be stopped immediately before any more lives are lost. It's just absolutely tragic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Caroline, can you see any path to a conclusion in this at this time? Because, as I say, I'm no expert. I probably understand a little bit about PR and how you can frame a victory, perhaps, right? And I just can't see how the United States particularly can. This seems to be very much stacked in Iran's favour, because they've tried everything. It doesn't seem to have done anything except bring the country together. And I'm not sure what they have left to try and leverage a deal that Trump can genuinely call a victory.
Well, I'm certainly no expert either, Greg, in this matter, but having listened to just even a programme last night where there was a general who is an expert in this field, and he was talking about how he doesn't see how they can, you know, take over the Strait of Hormuz. So I really don't know. I really don't really know how there's going to be a resolution in this. Hopefully there will be a peaceful one. At some point, they're going to have to sit down and try and resolve this, whether it's other leaders getting involved. I'm not really sure. But I would certainly like, and as India mentioned as well, you know, I think we need to be mindful while we're all talking about, you know, fuel costs and prices. There are lives being lost here as this continues to go on. And hopefully there will be a peaceful resolution soon. It's really all I can say on it.
Bringing in some listeners' comments here. Good morning, Greg. The carbon tax has to go, yet no one will even think about removing it. It's having no effect on habit. Need that woman said they have no lever. They have lots of levers for money for other countries. This is our money, not government money. We have a rainy day fund. Why isn't it used? As it's a rainy day for lots of people. We also have the Apple money. The Apple money has been spent a million times over, if the truth be told. But this is not unique to this country. In other countries, they're already rationing fuel as well. So it's not necessarily one particular country mishandling it, in inverted commas. Of the 60 cent per litre price increase, the government get over 60% of that. So that's 36%. Sorry, 36 cent per litre. They gave 20 cent per litre back, so we're happy to keep 16 cent per litre profit on the increase, part of the price alone, on top of the 130 per litre they were getting before this. Slap in the face to the Irish trying to heat their homes, says a listener. It is quite regrettable and can't be overstated, the disappointment that nothing was done in terms of home heating oil. Caroline, I'm sure you would agree in relation to that. The minister on with us said there's no excise duty on it to get rid of. I think that's what he said. But still, it's only by the grace of God we're heading into the spring. Caroline.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It is. Well, hopefully, I mean, it is coming down. Like I mentioned earlier, it has come down a couple of hundred euro on 1,000 litres. But obviously, we would be hoping for more reduction in that because, as some of your listeners mentioned, we're still... it's still costing more than it did on February 28th when all this started. So all we can do is hope and wait that it will come down a little bit. What else can we do at this point? Only plan ahead.
Yeah, indeed. OK, we'll come back to that. With the National Children's Hospital project recently surpassing its 18th missed completion deadline and total approved costs exceeding 2.24 billion, to what extent is the fixed price contract model to blame for the ongoing financial disputes between the state and the lead contractors? And even, I suppose, beneath that rather complex question, India, what the blooming hell's going on? How can we have so many slipped deadlines, still no end date in sight, it would seem? An absolute mess. You're muted, India, I believe, which I'm actually really quite particularly disappointed in you. Go ahead.
Sorry, it's not like me, Greg, at all. Oh, it's an absolute disaster, Greg. I completely agree with you. Like, I mean, the fixed price contract model was chosen to provide cost certainty and transfer risk to the lead contractor. And there's nobody being held accountable at the minute for this. Nobody's saying it's our fault, we messed up. If this was a job anywhere else in the world, somebody would be in court. They wouldn't even be held accountable. They'd be in court over this. I think the delays are a disgrace, and they're a disgrace to the children of Ireland as well, that are heavily relying on this hospital to be reopened to avail of its services, and they're still waiting, and they're going to wait. Like, you'd like to think that by the time it is all opened, it will be worth it, it'll be ready, but with the delays now and the advance in technologies in medicine, is it going to cause further delays and further delays down the road? Who knows?
John?
The sad thing about that at the moment is that children who had been waiting for numbers of years to be treated in this new hospital have outgrown that status, and they're beyond that now. And, you know, it's a tragic situation that only half the rooms, slightly less than half, 5,728 rooms in a children's hospital. What do you need all that for? That doesn't make much sense, does it? But, I mean, somewhere it has gone totally wrong from day one, from the applied for. Planning permission was granted around 10 years ago. It was to go to contact 15, 16 or thereabouts. And as you said, 18 delays. We don't know how many more they're going to be, because there weren't any great degrees of clarity provided yesterday when we were just told that it'll be another 15 days before they'll come up with another finish date. Now, after that, let's presume that'll be sometime later on this year. It's going to take a further 7 months for full commissioning of it. So it's going to be 2027 at the very earliest, and if it could even be beyond that. And I can see the whole thing ending up in court anyway, because the contractor is seeking extra money, obviously, for the services provided, because things got changed as they went along. The minister is going to defend that. I think we're talking about a figure of 40 million there that the contractor says is outstanding, and the department says it's not outstanding. So you have a whole morass of disasters built into it. Whether we got it wrong the first day or what we didn't do is very hard to know. But the size of it is mind-boggling. And I can see this hospital not being finished until 2028, maybe. Like we're heading in that way. Now, they have to start recruiting staff in April, because they're going to need 570 staff or thereabouts, which I thought would be a lot more, but it's not. They'll be recruiting them from the children's hospitals in and around Dublin, but they'll be in employment from July. Now, what they're going to be doing at that point, given that it might be another year before it's commissioned, I'm not too sure if there's any easy way out of this. This probably needed a very detailed review and investigation as to where it has all gone wrong. I think we're going to need that anyway, because we're not managing to get works done that we should be getting done on time or on track or indeed on contract prices. We seem to have this Achilles heel in Ireland now in the public service, that nothing seems to go according to plan. Things are priced way beyond where they should be, probably. And I keep saying and I keep writing about this, given that I worked in the health service for 21 years. There seems to be a price on nothing right now. There's a contract figure that seems to go out the window very, very quickly. Now, whether the contract details are being drawn up incorrectly, and whether they were never going to be achievable anyway. And that could be the real problem here with the National Children's Hospital, that to construct all those rooms and to have it opened in, 4 or 5 years ago, it was never achievable, I believe. But, I mean, where is the government in all this? They're sitting on their hands, because it's out of their control at this point, it would seem, that it's between the Ministers for Health and BAM, the contractor. And it's the Children of Ireland who are waiting, who are paying that big, big price. And it should not have happened that way. It's easy for us sitting here to criticise this, but there's so many government jobs we over-contract, and there's never been a proper investigation into why that's happening.
Well, that's it. You see, there's no assurances as to we know what happened and how we can make sure this doesn't happen again. I mean, we're still awarding contracts to the same company.
Yeah, but we're awarding contracts to many other companies as well that all come in on time and on scale. Mm. You know, like this is much bigger. But then again, still, it's only 2.2 million. It's not a big contract in real terms, you know. Like for a country the size of ours, for a hospital that size way back 10, 12 years ago, 650,000 was the contract price. Mm. That never seemed realistic. It just never did seem realistic. A million didn't seem realistic. But somewhere around a million might have been more realistic. But now it's 2.5 times that. And we're never going to get answers to this unless somebody comes in here, and we probably can't afford that anyway. And there's a full root and branch review of every aspect and every stage of design and planning, because it would seem there a couple of years back.
That sounds to me like a project that could end up costing another couple of billion and achieving nothing.
Easily. Now the ventilation shafts are too noisy. A couple of years ago, there was equipment that was no longer seen fit for purpose because the regulations had been upgraded. And like a long-term project like that that's going on for 10 years, this is going to keep happening and happening all over again, you know. And I just feel sorry for those families who have children waiting to be treated in that new hospital, because they could be waiting a long, long time.
Yeah, Caroline?
I would agree there with what John, that was sort of my take on it as well. Firstly, you know, let's get this job done. It's too long. There clearly has been issues in the procurement process. There are clearly issues on timeline, completion deadlines. Obviously, there's a lot of learns, and I hope the learns will be there. But first and foremost, get the job done. There are children waiting, families waiting. The impact of this, we need this hospital finished. And as John said there, as time goes on, not only is there a significant cost continuously, but technology, things are changing, everything's changing. So the more time and delays there are, the more changes and the more cost ultimately. And at the end of the day, our children are waiting on, their families need this hospital. We need to get it done. These people need to come together. They need to resolve it. I know the minister says she's going to, in a statement there the other day, that she's going to sort of meet the resources and get it done. But they really do need to figure this out and get it done. There are plenty of experts in this field.
Yeah, okay. Back with you. Yes, go ahead, John, please.
It's probably outside of the minister's control at this point. She inherited this from previous ministers, including Simon Harris, back in the day when he was the health minister. But we have never got on top of this job. And I think that's indicative of public service spending. It needs to be reined in, and much more stringent regulations applied to every aspect of it. Because, I mean, if you have a contractor now that's so many years on the job, he has 560 workers on site all the time. The minister wants more workers on site to get it finished. He probably is not going to budge on that. So within that, there needs to be a third-party intervention there at some level and with some more insight into how quickly we can get it resolved. Because if BAM keep making this demand to be paid, and I'm not saying they're right or wrong because I wouldn't have a clue, but if the minister is refusing that, then you're stuck with a 40 million black hole. That's never going to, all that it's going to do is increase and increase all over again.
Yeah.
And we could be talking about this time next year again.
I think we might be, actually.
We might not have made very much progress. But all the while, the children of the nation who are waiting for this are going to go on waiting, and probably their condition is not going to improve. I'm thinking of scoliosis and things like that there.
Yeah.
And it's an absolute disgrace that this situation has been allowed to develop. And it's just, nobody seems to be actually in control, or nobody can put their hand up and say, I am responsible for that. I mean, that would never, and you would know this, Caroline, if you're running a business, you are out in Castle Grove. If something goes wrong, somebody has to account for it to make sure it doesn't happen again. It's the same in our own business in Mufford there.
The business wouldn't last without a chain of responsibility or a chain of command. It simply wouldn't. You couldn't have a situation whereby, you know, someone completely cocked up a massive order and no one was going to take responsibility, because ultimately how could you ensure that that person was no longer responsible for that type of stuff, or that it wouldn't happen again? And we're talking about this on a national multi-billion euro scale.
But like, is that not the problem within the public service, that really it's all about spending money, and when things go wrong, nobody is held accountable and things move on to the next catastrophe? We've seen that in the government's own spending around Leinster House with bike sheds and all this kind of stuff, and there seems to be no limit to the amount of money that's needed.
Mm.
And do we ever learn any lessons from it?
Okay.
The answer is we don't, you know.
A texter says 30 women in Northern Ireland have been killed since 2020. Why are we failing to protect women and children? This the day after Amy was laid to rest following her very tragic death at the weekend, her murder last weekend. India, a lot of listeners sort of looking for use in relation to this. There's something seriously amiss. And let me say, every time we talk about this, people want to point out that men are victims of domestic violence too. And of course they are. But we're talking about 30 women dead in the space of 26 years in six counties. How concerned are you at where we're at, and how we don't seem to be seeing any improvement in this? In fact, all statistics seem to indicate that this situation is indeed getting worse.
It's 100% getting worse, Greg. It's very scary as a young woman to have to worry about things like this. You always think that growing up in Donegal, you're very safe. But aspects like this with domestic violence and violence against women, it's all across the board. It doesn't matter where you live. It's happening to women all across the world, all across the county, all across the country, and it's not getting any better. I was involved with the panel discussion with Gore Media in 2020. I was a regular panelist with them. And we were discussing violence against women after Ashley Murphy had passed away. And we were talking about it then. We were talking about how there needs to be a change before it gets worse. And it's quadrupled since then. It's hard to know how you can fix this situation. You know, do you go back to schools? Do you go into schools and do you teach from a young age? Because it's very difficult to teach a child something and then they'll go home and they'll see what they think is normal in their household, and try and get them to differentiate between what is real at home and what's real in the real world. And then you have the whole online aspect and the treatment of women online through various sites. That has a massive role to play in it as well. But it's so hard to know how you can stop this. But, you know, as a young woman, it's something that I'm very concerned about. But as someone with a brother, you know, he has to grow up in that world. He has to be aware that there's also aspects of false accusations too that can ruin a man's life. It's not all men, but there's a lot of men that have a lot of things to be held accountable for, and there's a lot more education. I think education is the biggest thing.
Yeah, and I think men, and I'm not talking about anyone, but I think men need to be more secure about themselves. And when we're talking about things like this, obviously it's not all men. Clearly, obviously, it's not. But that doesn't mean, because you know, you should know that people should be confident enough in themselves that this isn't me. They're not talking about me. This is a bigger issue. John, what's your views in relation to this? It's just like, because I mean, obviously, there's a we're seeing the awful case in Northern Ireland and the figures from Northern Ireland. This is all over the place. You'll know yourself from conversations with Gardaí at the weekends. A lot of their calls, domestic calls, are domestic abuse. You know, there have been cases of murders, but there's also lots of cases of, you know, very serious injury that aren't reported as domestic abuse instances. It's getting worse and worse and worse, it feels. Well, it doesn't feel, it's actually provable.
What strikes me about those situations is the barbarity and the sheer violence used against women. This is absolutely and totally out of control. Indiana referenced Ashley Murphy, which is very good, because, you know, there's so much going to be put in place to protect women, and all of these plans and ideas. Has any progress been made on any one of them? Do we have protection for women at all that is safe for them to go out at night? When you have that level, you just look at the court cases. The amount of violence in the home is absolutely brutal as well. Now, there has to be a much bigger societal dimension to all of this, you know. Is it drug-related? You know, have we any statistics at all on drug use or abuse in the home? Probably not. But, I mean, the situation has got much, much worse, and I'm afraid we're not tackling it in any coherent manner, or we don't seem to have any particular policies in place. Do we have any enforcement in place that where there is a risk of violence, that is going to be tackled before it develops into something serious? You know, murders probably can be preventative if the situation is tackled in time. I know that there's going to be these crazy murders, but the state seems to be failing women and failing them very, very badly. And I'm sad to be sitting here saying this in 1926, but I think things are much more serious now. And Indiana, you're out there as a young woman. You probably see it a lot more than we do, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Caroline? Sorry, Indy, come back in there, please.
No, I just wanted to come in to say, obviously I mentioned Ashley Murphy. After Ashley Murphy passed away, we all kind of talked amongst ourselves about it. And I remember on the Friday morning, I went to walk Merva Beach. You know it well yourself, Greg. And never have I ever felt in any way unsafe on that beach. And that was the first day that I said, God, I'm not actually safe. If she can't even go for a run in her own hometown, I'm not safe to go for a walk on Merva Beach.
What I find I find also quite strange as well is that we live in a society where the likes of that HT Tiki Toki or whatever his name is, or the Tate Brothers or whatever, that it's up for debate whether or not their attitudes and their language is okay or not. Like the fact that people will argue that, no, that's okay, that's what we need, that's the type of memory we need now, and others will go, no, they're absolutely... The fact that the kind of language they use and the way they speak of women is up for debate is really quite remarkable. And I'm not trying to be all holier than thou, but it really is really quite remarkable that it's not straight off, no, you can't be given a platform to speak to young lads like that, or even to young girls who then maybe have some unrealistic...
But, you know, where does social media play into this? Because you can seem to be fit to use and abuse social media where you couldn't get away with it elsewhere. Why has that not been tackled? Or is that a part of the issue?
Well, it's tied up with free speech, you see, and as soon as you come for any element of what's said on social media, you're coming for free speech, and yeah, we know what the US administration think of that, for an example.
There is a price for free speech, and that's being responsible. Otherwise, you end up on a libel charge or in court. But if it's on social media, nothing happens. And we're talking about this for 20 years because social media has got worse and worse, and it's got more abusive because people are allowed to do that.
Or are we allowed to see it? Was it always happening anyways? Were toxic masculine influencers there previously in the schoolyard or in the pub or at the sports hall, but we're actually now seeing them because they're on a public platform? Because this...
Well, I was working in the community and mental health issues away back in the mid-1980s. We were dealing with small bits of abuse, but nothing at all on the scale that's there now. It was, you know, You might have a caseload of 400 or 500 clients in the year. You mightn't get two cases of it, and you were fit to resolve it. You know, it was just a lot of misunderstanding and not enough money about the house and a bit of poverty and a bit of drinking. But this has got to a whole new level of absolute madness and violence. It's not enough to abuse a woman, but to literally destroy her whole body.
Caroline Sweeney, what's your view?
Yeah, I think it's shocking just listening to everybody here. I mean, it's definitely shocking what's happening. And I do think part of society is changing, of course. And I think the levels, and I just, you know, I'm listening there to you even, Greg, and I'm thinking, I wonder, did some of this go on previously? And then I heard John's take on it there, and we just weren't aware of it. We weren't so educated on it. But I think a big part is, and it's not just women, I know we're talking about women specifically here, but it's violence in general. And I think, you know, we need to, starting from in schools, an education piece around the respect. I think there might be a lot of other mental health problems perhaps involved. You know, I'm not an expert in this field by any means, it's just my opinion. But I definitely think, you know, there needs to be more maybe legislation around it. You know, people need to be held accountable when these things, you know, these things shouldn't get to the level of murder. They shouldn't get that far. Things should be dealt with. There should be systems in place to prevent, to protect before it gets that far. Because, I mean, the stats...
Yeah, but you have fantastic organisations in Donegal here, Donegal Domestic Violence Services, Lifeline, Inishon, etc. They're struggling for accommodation to meet the needs that are there. I presume they could do with more resources for more outreach, more counselling. They're doing great things in relation to that. But they are two organisations that are very busy. In Donegal, we have the Gardaí take domestic violence incredibly serious, and there's some fantastic people working in domestic violence services. So I'm not saying there's not enough there, but that is there. And yet we are seeing this epidemic of domestic violence. That's, you know, I know there's more we could do, but I can't understand how it's getting worse when there's so much conversation, quite a bit of calling out, and some resources there to deal with it. It's worrying. It worries me.
My take on that, Greg, is that we have a much bigger population and we have less resources accordingly. Remember that the population has grown by 2 million since 1990. The services needed haven't kept pace with that. Let that be in hospital, mental health care or counselling or any of those things. There's a big, big shortage of social workers. There's a big, big shortage of all health professionals. Mm. So, you know, the other thing that we have a huge shortage of is we have really very little enforcement on any issue in Ireland. Mm. No, we don't have enough Gardaí for starters. Gardaí do a massive role because they're at the coalface of these issues. They're going to be the first people to be called there. They're to be to the family home, and they're there to keep the peace.
Okay.
They may be very good in many other ways, but we don't have the. We don't have the skilled personnel where these people can be brought to see and get counselling. It's not there.
India.
I just want to come in and say, Caroline mentioned about legislation. Coco's Law and Jenny's Law are two laws that are being, two pieces of legislation that are being implemented at the minute to protect against violence against women and violence against men.
Well, they're not really. There's a lot of foot dragging going on there.
Yeah, but you'd like to think that legislations like that they might enact change, like, you know, I think...
Well, a register of offenders would be useful, but it's still we're taking forever to put it into place.
Women can't
wait and men can't wait because they're being severely injured or abused or killed in the meantime. But I take your point. India Kennedy, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today. Have a great weekend. Look after yourself.
For having me, Greg.
Bye-bye. John McAteer, always a pleasure. Chat to you soon.
Thanks, Greg.
All right, bye-bye. And last but not least, Caroline Sweeney. It's been a pleasure having you on the programme, and look after yourself. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, goodbye. Quite a few of us from Highland heading down to Dublin for the Donegal Person of the Year celebrations tomorrow night. Really looking forward to it. Our very own Paddy Keeney is being honoured. He is the Donegal Person of the Year, and what a fantastic man for that position. Not to take anything away from Paddy, of course, but I am going down as the defending Donegal Person of the Year Best Dressed Male 2025. I'm not sure if it's ever been won. I'm not sure if there's ever been back-to-back winners. I know Noel Cunningham was Donegal Person of the Year because of COVID for about half a century. But anyway, could it be done? Could it be done? I wonder if Paddy Power taking odds on it. The retention of the... Well, we'll see. We'll see. I can only hope. But anyway, we'll report back on that Monday and tell you how it went. But it's fantastic that, all jokes aside, Paddy Keeney is getting the credit that he deserves. It's the reason we're all here in terms of this radio station. OK. Right. Greg, I look forward to seeing who wins Best Dressed at this year's Donegal Person of the Year Ball. Not only do you lead the way in current affairs... Now, listen to this. Not only do you lead the way in current affairs, but you are now a fashion trailblazer. Yeah, I mean, I can't deny that. I simply can't deny it. I'm normally modest, but you're right. I can't wait for the Greg Hughes by McElhenney celebration or collaboration. Yes, I'm always open to collaborations. Not this year, though, I don't believe. I don't know who I'm going to wear, but I haven't got the call. So if I'm going to have to win it, I'm going to have to win it on my own. You got a lot of stick at the time for your communion shoes, but you didn't get Best Dressed at the Donegal Ball for nothing. The white shoes, and they did come from McElhenney's, actually. Yes, the white shoes, in fact, were quite a problem. I liked them. I thought I looked great. And it wasn't me that decided to wear them, but they've gone now. Right, let me see. The podcast, our podcast is available for you. And maybe I don't talk enough about it because we are on podcast 12 or 13 at the moment. And I have to say, we've had a wonderful reaction to it. And it's available for you in lots of places. We release, it's a sister podcast to this show. We release a new interview every Friday morning at 11 o'clock. And I'll go through some of the guests for you early next week. Where do you get the podcast? It's available for you in the listen back section of our website, highlandradio.com. But it is also on Spotify and iTunes as well. So if you search Spotify or iTunes, I don't really use iTunes, but I presume it's the same. You will see the Greg Hughes podcast. Just serve that, search that. And what you get there, firstly, please, if you could give us a like, a subscribe and a review, it really helps. But you'll see the podcast of this show every single day. But on a Friday, then you get the additional sister podcast. And as I say, these are real people, real stories from showbiz to books to just regular folks that have done 65 years of hard graft in the county to the guests we have today. You'll never think it's going to knock on your door twice. That was one of the lines that jumped out from me from this Friday's podcast. I sit down with Gary and Patrice McCrossan for a moving and courageous conversation. They're just a regular couple that have gone through an extraordinary time. They open up about their family's dual battle with cancer, sharing the raw reality of navigating the journey with both mum and their beautiful son, Zach, being diagnosed in a year. It's a story of resilience, the strength of a family bond, and the reality of facing life's toughest challenges head on. You can hear the whole thing at 11. I'm going to play for you a clip now. We've been talking about Patrice's diagnoses, and very shortly thereafter, Patrice particularly, but Gary as well, noticed that Zach, he was lethargic. He just wasn't, you know, he just wasn't as energetic as a young boy of his age might be. And they took him for a series of tests. They weren't very satisfied with the diagnoses and said, look, you know, we want to get him tested. We think there's something else going on here. And he eventually ended up down in Dublin for tests. And we pick up the conversation, really, I suppose, when they're just about to be told that Zach is not a very well boy.
So when we were in Temple Street, again, we were just down for blood results, but I wasn't expecting anything anyway. I think that's kind of after I kind of had it in my head that, you know, it's going to be something completely different and not anywhere near as serious. But again, we were taken into a room, and once the room, mm-hmm. we see the room, you kind of know. Mm-hmm. But I think I was just more angry than anything that particular time. Mm-hmm.
Why? Angry with life or angry
just
with the
angry
system?
Just angry in general, not with the system, just in general. Adult cancer and child cancer is two very, very different things. And you're so helpless, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was just so angry that day, but it took a little bit of letting it sink in to kind of get proactive and stuff like that. And I suppose money was a big thing for me, trying to make sure everyone was going to be supported. We've already been through almost a year of the family being split up. So that was the toughest part for me. So,
the treatment then was so you were told effectively that the treatment that he needs is not available here, or what was the conversation at that point? And is that on that same day, or well, it doesn't matter if it's on the same day in the same space. Yeah, like
I think it was.
That just says that he would have to go to either the UK or the Netherlands for the treatment.
We didn't
get to pick or anything. It was just they send out an email and whatever hospital suits best.
Yeah.
But I mean, then the reality of the situation is first you're dealing with that and all the emotions of that, but also the practicality of it, right? You, so, as you said, Gary, you're already split for a year.
Yeah.
Who goes where? I presume your treatment at home as well has to be factored in, or was there a convenient gap or?
Yeah, well, she gave me oral chemo to take with me.
Before we went, we weren't even sure. Like, we knew Netherlands was coming, but at the start, we didn't even know if you were going to be able to go or not. I think it was further down, closer to the time of going to Netherlands, that you got kind of the green light to go as well. Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of
it. Would have been very difficult for you if you had to stay at home.
Yeah.
Almost impossible. Like, I wonder, would you have started making calls on your own treatment at that stage?
I know.
You know what I mean? You don't even have to go down that route, I would imagine it would have been incredibly tough. Yeah. So if there was a small chink of light at that time, maybe that's it. And are you given a time frame as to how long Zach's treatment would be in the Netherlands?
Just or? Said around 6 months.
Wow. Yeah.
So what was the plan then?
when the Netherlands was confirmed, I just went into organising planning mode. The big one for me, obviously, to start off with was money. There are some fantastic charities. I'm not going to start naming any today, but there are some fantastic support channels available in the country. But we're also very lucky that we have a fantastic community here as well. I suppose my intentions were, number one, that I wanted to try and find accommodation over there that would fit our own direct family, but also the help.
What was the plan? How many of you were to go over then? So
it depended on the funding me. Yeah. If we were able to get some money together,
because you have to be there for Zach, right? But you need a support structure
for the other kids as well.
Yeah.
You know, we were lucky it landed on the summertime. You know, our date to go was June, and the rest of the kids were in summer holidays. So, your parents had offered to come over, which was a great help. So that meant that I could start looking.
Yeah, so that's just part of the conversation, and the full podcast available for you just as we go off air at 11 o'clock on our website, highlandradio.com. And it's a fascinating conversation, and it's an insight into many, many things. Firstly, these are ordinary people, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. We're all ordinary people, right? We're not celebrities. We're not royals. We're just regular people. But sometimes we are delivered with extraordinary situations to have to deal with, and you wonder how do you cope with that. And then the practicalities start hitting home. You're told for your son to survive, for your son to get better, you have to go out to the Netherlands. But how do you fund that? And then you have to make the decision as to whether or not you'll accept the generosity of the community. We are so generous. But that's not easy. And in that interview, a little later on in it, or a little bit before that, Gary talks about how that was difficult. And it is difficult for both of them, even though long before Patrice ever had her diagnosis, she was very active in getting involved in charities and what have you. And when Aisling was organising her event for charity last Sunday, one of the first persons on the phone was Patrice, saying, listen, I'm a hairdresser, I can come down, I can help out. And but still, even though
it all makes sense that we all support each other when we need our support. It's interesting getting insight that people feel uncomfortable about that, feel uncomfortable at having to sort of accept help, if you can, if you could put it to you like that. So you can listen to the whole conversation. It's about 45 minutes and it's on our website, highlandradio.com, from 11 a.m. And listen to it whenever you want. I'm not saying turn over and listen at 11. And also on Spotify and iTunes. And if you can give us a subscribe and a maybe even a favourable comment, if you don't mind, on Spotify and iTunes, we'd really appreciate that because it helps get the message out there. And there is a very interesting back catalogue of podcasts there already. And it all just sprung from having a little extra time with this show going from 3 to 2 hours. And it's proved very, very popular. And we really appreciate your support in that regard. So spread the word, share them out on your socials as well. All very much appreciated. Zach went back to school, or went to school for the first time, by the way, in March, on March the 12th. He headed off to Skullmore, gone small. And a fantastic day for mum and dad, because you never know if you're going to see these days, but they did, and he's doing well. But you can find out how everyone's doing, because Patrice is still on her journey, by listening to that podcast, which, as I say, is available from 11. Now, Highland Radio's jackpot, the bingo jackpot, is now sitting at €15,000. Books are only €5 each and can be bought at Storts all over the county or here at Highland Radio. It's a chance for you to win big money, but you also support the work of Vision Ireland. And this collaboration between us and Vision Ireland is one of their biggest fundraising efforts in a year. And they provide fantastic work. And it's ongoing with people, but unfortunately people find out news about their eyes on a daily basis, and they're there to help and support people. A fantastic charity and organisation. It's great to be a part of them. And we talk often about the jackpot, which is great, 15 grand. But like, I think it's a minimum of 400 quid a day is the daily prize. 400 quid every single day, right? And if it's not won, it rolls over. And it is then won. It's added 100 or 200 every day then until such time as it's won. So there's people actually, and I probably should be mentioning it more, there's people winning hundreds and hundreds of euro every other day by the shout. And then this jackpot is here as well. And all the while, tickets just €5. It's not a club, by the way. You don't have to be part of the Highland Radio Bingo Club. You just buy a book when you're in the shop, and you could be a winner. Someone's going to win this 15 grand, and someone definitely is going to win the cash prizes that come up that are available for you every day. And the tickets are just a fiver, and you're supporting Vision Ireland. What about that? As you've been hearing on Highland Radio this morning, Donegal County Council has granted conditional planning permission for a shop and forecourt close to the site of the Chrysler tragedy over 3 years ago, coming upon 4 years in October. 10 lives were lost. Hard to believe it. It still really is hard to believe, even as you say, 10 lives were lost when the explosion happened. Amongst them was, of course, 14-year-old Leona Harper, who was buying ice cream with her friend. We're joined by her mum now, Donna Harper. Donna, thanks very much for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, so we've spoken in the past about information and families receiving information. I know, say, for instance, with An Garda Síochána, you have your liaisons officers and they understand the importance of this to families, and the fact that families get that information first. There is that sensitivity there. Is that the same with this planning process, given the fact that we're talking about just over 3 years removed from 10 lives being lost in a single site? Are you given full warning that an announcement of planning permission is going to be made, or how does that work?
No, Greg, this is the second application now, as most people are aware of. And this is the second time that we have never been told. We're going into three and a half years here now. We have, as families, survivors and so on, and people affected, we have been trying to talk to council for 3.5 years, and still to this day we're no further forward with it, with the Donegal County Council. It's very, very disappointing to find out again through media outlets that the planning was passed. Councillor, nobody has ever sat down with us in regards to anything. If I want to go to Chrysler to Leiflowers for my daughter, who was killed there and standing at the side of a road laying a lock of flowers. Donegal County Council has never even engaged with us or talked to us even about memorials. And we have been trying to do that as well for almost 3.5 years.
Why is there no progress in that regard? Because, you know, unfortunately, we've had tragedies on this island, tragedies in islands close to us. And, you know, almost instantly, it seems to be the fact that this is seen as sacred, that something needs to be put in place for people to go and pay their respects. But in this case, sometimes it feels like, forget about it, move on. We have to move on here now. There's other things to be at. We don't need to put up a memorial there. You can continue to go and stand at the side of this 20-foot hoarding.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it feels like, Greg, because we just feel like nobody's listening to us. Nobody wants to listen to us. Nobody's sitting down talking to us. You know, and as people are aware as well, Jim O'Callaghan's refusing to meet the families. And that's very hard to understand why that is. I mean, this is one of the biggest investigations in the history of the state. 10 people were killed. We have no answers. We don't know what happened. There's an ongoing criminal investigation. On the first application, there was submissions put in. And ourselves, we had put submissions in, and along with other people on the first application. That wasn't even looked at, really, by Donegal County Council. They just went ahead and passed it. Obviously, then we had went at that time to inboard Planala, and they had stopped the application. But they had stopped the application, Greg, on different things. And one of the things that they stopped it on was safety, on the grounds of safety and concerns and stuff.
But they
that
couldn't.
Was actually one of the,
yeah, but they couldn't consider
yeah,
but it on the basis of the, emotion, though. Yeah. That's Donna.
We do understand that. But yeah, one of the submissions that actually went in regards from ourselves, we actually spoke about this, you know, safety and so on. Mm-hmm. They didn't even look at that. Mm-hmm. They just went ahead and passed it.
Yeah.
But then Anbord Planala had refused it on basically the same grounds as what we had put in.
Mm-hmm.
And the council didn't even look at that. I think at this stage now, there's very serious questions that need to be answered to us.
Okay,
but
Donna, just in relation
you're looking
to
at a second
that,
application,
Donna, just in relation to that, and you can talk about that, but I just
of course.
Although this is an unimaginable tragedy, and there are many people think that nothing should be built either on or near that site. In fairness to the planners, they can only consider what they might consider if this tragedy never happened at all. In other words, you know, sight lines on roads, the speed of traffic, the level of traffic, you know, whether or not the development is aligned with the county development plan, the need in the local area, you know, they are the only factors that they can make this decision on. They cannot consider the emotion of it or the human impact of it, because the planning doesn't have those guidelines contained within. Do you get where I'm coming from? And you know how sympathetic I am to this situation.
I understand where you're coming from, Greg, but if you go back and you actually look at some of the submissions that went in for the first application, it wasn't just about grieving families, it wasn't just about emotions. Mm. There was also stuff in that about the safety concerns and about other concerns. It wasn't just about grieving. They didn't even look at that. They just went ahead and still passed it.
Mm.
But then when it was appealed to Anbord Planala, Anbord Planala just turned it down for a lot of the same reasons that was already put in there in the first place.
Yeah.
So when Anbord Planala turned that down for some of them reasons, why did Donegal County Council not even look at it? You know, why did they just go ahead and pass it?
I mean,
they might be coming back saying, oh, it was just grieving families. But I'm sorry, did they not even read some of the submissions that went in? It wasn't just about grieving families.
There were some very
serious concerns within them applications that was put in for submissions. It wasn't just that we're just grieving.
Mm. It
wasn't even looked at.
The site of the tragedy will not be built on now, but the plans that have been approved by the council are nearby. Is it reasonable for the families to continue to object, even though now the actual site in and of itself is free potentially to be developed as an appropriate memorial, and that the needs of the community also do have to be met, i.e. is this the middle ground whereby the site is respected and can be developed appropriately to remember the 10 lives we've lost, but also to the practical needs of a community, a thriving community, you know, in terms of tourism, etc., to be met? Is this not the middle ground, Donna?
Well, I think considering that where the explosion happened, it was a massive explosion, killed 10 people, injured numerous people as well, and some of these people have lifelong injuries, that we're still at the fact that we don't even know what happened and what caused that blast. We have no idea. It's still an ongoing investigation. But then the site is literally within two steps beside each other. That's how close it is. So if we ever did get a memorial garden there, which the families have been asking for, somewhere to sit down and reflect, how could you sit down and reflect there when you've got more or less a replica next door to you that killed your daughter? It's going to be noisy, it's going to be hustle, it's going to be bustle right next door. How do you begin to sit in a memorial garden and reflect of what just happened to your daughter being killed, where you stood 24 hours waiting to get her out? Nobody's saying that Chrysla doesn't need a shop. Of course, they need their amenities down there, of course. But I'm also aware that there is another plan and application down there as well for a shop. As well, I think the decision on that was to be made in June. I'm not 100% sure, but that's what I've been made aware of. You know, it's not as if there was... I just find it hard, Greg, that there was absolutely nowhere else in Chrysla to do this except within 2 feet from the site of the explosion. And the worrying part of it is, as well, Greg, is that we don't even know what caused that explosion yet. We have no idea. So I just find it hard to understand how that's able to go ahead. I mean, our lives are sitting here on hold. You know, we have no answers. We know nothing. So how is that allowed just to happen when there's no answers as to what caused it in the first place and left such devastation?
Yes, and I don't think there's a person listening to this interview right now, Donna, that can understand why you have to fight to have an inquiry to find out what happened, how it happened, what maybe guidelines weren't followed, potentially, maybe they all were, or what lessons can be learned to prevent something like this happening in the future. There is others, though, that will say, and I don't mean this insensitive at all, but if, you know, you talk of a reminder being next door, but I mean, maybe that could be shielded in some way, you know, or people might say to you, well, if a car passes in front of it, in a way, that could be a reminder, you know. And you know, again, Donna, I'm not being insensitive. I'm just wondering, in terms of public support, if people will fully get, not at all. Yeah,
not at all. No, I understand that, Greg. And I mean, I've been reading some of the comments that have been put up on social media in regards to this as well. And everybody has their own views on it as well, but when you're the first-hand affected family...
Of course, that's the
thing
you see.
I mean, I stood myself for 24 hours. 24 hours waiting to get my daughter back.
Yes.
Who was lying in there, who was killed from a massive explosion, and there's no answers. I mean, is there no worry or concern as to... Does people not really want to know what really happened that day? You know,
it's just
going forward and safety lines, you know, and could it have been prevented that day? We just don't know. We don't know the answers to that yet. And to me, that's just a worry. You know, I was reading comments as well, Greg, and people were saying that that the media don't want to talk to anybody in regards to this, only the families. I found that quite hurtful, to be honest, because I know firsthand that the media have been trying to talk to other people.
That's completely untrue.
Besides the families, and they have refused to speak.
And people have made decisions. People have made their own decisions. That's their approach. It's not the fact. It's not for the want of. And to be honest with you, there's quite a lot of people. This is one of those issues, or even elected representatives for that matter. Not all, but some, that it's too complicated to touch because there are a sizable proportion of people in that area who perhaps want this to go ahead. You know what I mean? And people are looking at ballot boxes and public opinion and stuff. Yeah. It's very, very complex. There's no doubt about that. But I mean, we do need to talk and we need to move forward. with the conversation.
Well, that's the thing, Greg. That's definitely one of the things. Like, we need to be talking to people, and that's the thing. Like, we're sitting here 3.5 years later, and for them 3.5 years, we have been trying to talk ourselves to Donegal County Council, and nobody would talk to us.
Yeah.
Then they did say that they would talk to us about a regeneration programme, but I know I can speak for my own family on this. We have no problem with a regeneration programme going in Chrysler, and it's great that it's been brought to the village, and great for them. We have no problem with that. We have other questions that we need to be talking to Donegal County Council about, and they haven't to this day ever spoken to us about it. To me, that's very, very disappointing. You know, 10 people were killed on that site. Why is Donegal County Council not talking to us about this? Why is it now for the second time that we had to read this
And I just want to talk a little bit too about how we as a people are dealing with this. When this happened, the day it happened, the days afterwards, everyone was shocked to beyond belief, traumatised. And I'm not talking about the likes of yourself. I'm on about the community. This was just unbelievable. Now, what's happened since, and what happens with the passage of time, when you're not directly affected by it, those feelings pass. Mm-hmm. And it's 3.5 years removed, which is yesterday, effectively. And it's a human condition. A lot of those same people I described who were beyond grief in the days afterwards have now gone, well, life moves on. Things move on. You have to move forward. It was 3.5 years ago. And in that moment, when we think like that, we do not think about the people who were directly affected by it, the people who lost loved ones there, the people who suffered injury there, the people who have trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. Those people are still locked into that day. And I think just as we look on and as we want to move on, we kind of have to say, well, what if it was us? And we can't, you know, when it's just an interesting, actually almost observation of humanity. An example here from a listener, and I don't judge this person, but this is exactly what I'm talking about. It just was put in front of me. As a Chrysler resident, it's a complete pain to have to travel to Letterkenny for fuel. Yes, there's a village close by, but in a cost of living crisis, we can't afford these prices. While we've sympathy for the loss, life goes on. Now, I wonder, could that person ever have imagined writing that the week after it, you know, it's, and yet here we are. But as I say, I'm not judging that person. You know, you're clever, Donna. You know that those views are out there as well. What happens next? Do you appeal to An Bord Pleanála? Not you. When I say ye, I mean those who might be minded to do so.
Well, you know what, Greg? We do have a period of time before we would say that. So I think we're just going to sit down and just weigh up our options at the minute and where we're going to do what we're going to do next. And just see where we're going to go from there.
Do you know if it were me, what needs to happen personally? What needs to be happening? Whomever might be responsible for this needs to get families together and say, look, let's consider that this development is going ahead and let's consider what we can do as a memorial and see how they can sit beside each other or coexist. Have that conversation. Move it forward. Don't leave families in the dark or in a vacuum. Plough on with the development, and yet this hoarded, boarded site is still there when 10 lives were lost. That's what we don't do well in this country. Let's get together now and see how maybe the new development can be shielded from the memorial, or there can be measures to try and reduce sound or create a space that families feel that they can go there and mourn. Some may never go there ever. But if families do wish to, but not just the families those affected, now is this period, this window before a objection has to go in. Let's sit down now. Let the planning authorities sit down and say, well, what can we create that allows these two things potentially even to coexist? Maybe an agreement can't be reached on it, but unless it's talked about or moved forward, it's just going to be this.
Well, that's exactly what it is, Greg. I mean, this is all we've ever wanted from the council, was to sit down and talk to us in regards to the first application, regards to the second application, and sure, they're just not engaging with us. There was motions being passed in Donegal County Council where they were agreeing on things. You know, they were even going to be looking into, Greg, about CPO or seeing about CPO on the site. I mean, there was even motions passed in regards to that. And that was the end of that. Why has nobody nearly 4 years later ever come to us and says anything about a memorial site? Has anybody ever tried to to sit down and have any discussions with us about a memorial site. And the first application, Greg, at the time the first application went out, I sat and read in a local newspaper about a memorial that was supposedly proposed for the first application. And that was 10 steel poles with lights on it. And that's, I read that in a local newspaper, and I found that absolutely outrageous.
We all saw that imagery in the bikes.
You know, that was outrageous.
The bike parking and the bit of grass, and I know exactly where you're coming from.
And that was outrageous. And just in relation to the comment that your listener put in, that was a Creasler resident. Now, and I do understand that we're in an awful time here at the minute with the cost of petrol and diesel and everything else. But I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. But at the end of the day, you know, there was a massive explosion. It is one of the biggest investigations in the history of the state. 10 people were killed, numerous people with injuries and lifelong now PTSD and stress and everything else and lifelong injuries. I know that. And I know, you know, I'm not judging anybody. Everybody has their own opinion on this. But I wouldn't wish anybody to be standing in my shoes where I had to stand for 24 hours. You know, there's been a few articles that's gone out recently on the Sunday Times. And when I was reading what I was reading on them articles from different people, it's very, very hard to sit here when you're reading what other people were saying that actually kind of happened that day in Creasler. I think it's really, really important that we do get the truth, that we do know what happened. I would never, ever want anybody to be standing in my shoes. I would never want this to ever happen again to anybody. Never to lose your daughter and your child in the circumstances that we lost her.
Donna,
it's just unbearable. You know, it's every minute of every day you just think about it. So
I know,
it's very, very hard. I think that the council need to be talking to us.
She'd be 18 now.
But at the same time, Greg, I think at the same time, 3.5 years later, is it too late? I don't know.
Okay. Donna, thanks for your time. I appreciate it. I know it's not easy talking about these things either. That's Donna Harper, mother of Leona Harper, one of the 10 souls lost the day of that explosion. Yes, a caller says, heartbreaking to listen to Donna. How can our council put those people through more trauma? Surely the obvious thing to do is not make a decision until the investigation is concluded. Can't understand why they don't have answers yet. Morning, Greg. In relation to Creasler, I wonder if there was a community garden place there beside the shop, would maybe more people visit it? If I was going into that shop, I would definitely go over and say a prayer. What I'm trying to say is, the more people that would see this garden, the more this awful tragedy would be remembered by a wider group of people, as well as the grieving families. And I put that probably before you, probably after you messaged in. You know, why aren't we having a conversation about how these two things can coexist? The needs of the community can be met. The needs of the community and the bereaved families could be met. There has to be some design way in which it could be done appropriately. But if they're not being talked to at all, what do you do? There was a hotel fire in Donegal where a child was killed. That hotel is reopened and only recently put up a plaque in remembrance. I think the families have to accept for the majority life goes on. And we have to accept that that's the society we live in, because that's a call we're making. As difficult as it is for Donna and the families to hear this, I can't envisage their pain, but the community does need a shop. I, for one, am glad that planning has been granted. Please stop objecting and allow this development to continue. The building of the shop and a remembrance garden is what should happen. And my heart goes out to the families of victims following granting a planning application for this garage. And, you know, I think that's what this programme, this radio station, is important for in such a sensitive matter. We can respectfully platform the different views in relation to it, and I think we're lucky to have that we can have a space where people can have their feelings. Now, Donna Marie Doherty is a broadcast journalist with us here at Highland Radio, of course, and she sits in for me from time to time. Well, she has been looking at McGilligan Prison. It's been ranked amongst the highest performing in Britain and Northern Ireland following a major inspection. Inspectors praised its focus on safety, respect and rehabilitation. Donna Marie Doherty visited the prison to see how it operates day to day, speaking with Governor Gary Milling, Northern Ireland Justice Minister Naomi Long and a man serving a life sentence there. This report we're going to hear now explores a system focused not just on punishment, but also change and rehabilitation.
A major inspection has found McGilligan Prison to be one of the highest performing in the UK. A report which is released today praised the relationships between staff and prisoners along with rehabilitation work. The prison received top grades in four key areas, and that was safety, respect, purposeful activity and preparation for release. So I went to see it for myself. What stood out to me first was the atmosphere. It wasn't what I expected when I went in. There was a calmness there and a real focus on well-being and changing mindsets. Governor there is Gary Milling.
People arrive in prison for a variety of reasons. Now, I'm not apologising for that. I'm not saying that they did not commit a crime. They have. So what we look to do is to try to unpack that and build the person back up. Mm. It's about saying that you as a person are okay, but your behaviours and what you've done to hurt others are not. So the key part of that is about building up people's sense of self-worth. It's about providing them skills that they can then take back into the community, mm-hmm. so that they can then successfully resettle into the community as you and I would, as a normal person, and not have to revert to crime, not commit criminality, which then does have, unfortunately, knock-on effect.
And, Governor, what really struck me whenever I come in here is the atmosphere and how, you know, there was such banter between yourself and the prisoners.
Yeah.
But how many of them, you run this entire facility, how many of them you knew about on a first-name basis?
I know quite a lot of them on the first-name basis. So my role here is to sort of say, this is okay. This is okay to interact with people this way. This is okay. This is just about trying to normalise relationships. Mm. So the more normal relationships are, the more people will open up. The more people are likely to say to a member of staff, I've got some issues around this. I've got some issues around that. My family are getting it tight on the outside. My kids are having problems at school. And what that feeds into their journey, but it feeds into our ability to help those people. So a lot of my role is, after setting a strategic direction, you know, for the jail, is just being a normal member of staff and supporting my staff on the wings, or those range of support agencies that come in here.
While I was there, I interacted with a number of prisoners. Some were working, some were having lunch, and there was a few playing pool. Outside, we saw a garden area that had beanbags and even outdoor gym equipment. One prisoner who uses a wheelchair invited me in to see his cell, and it had been adapted to suit his needs. Then I was brought to the workshop, and this is where much of the practical work happens. One group there was building a swing set for a local school. Another man was spray painting shelves that are going to be used for offices within the prison itself. And then out in a side room, there was finished pieces lined up. There was wardrobes and lockers and chairs. And these were ready to be shipped out to other prisons to be used in the cells there. Justice Minister Naomi Long was also present. And she said this kind of work gives prisoners a sense of purpose. It helps them to develop skills for release, but it also reduces costs.
It's also really useful, I have to say, for us in prisons, because we do have very limited budgets in the Department of Justice, and some of the furniture that you see being built here today will be going into the prisons themselves. And you can see, for example, some of the pieces that have been built for some of the local primary schools, so things like swing sets and different things that are built for the local primary schools that they wouldn't be able to afford either, given constrained budgets in education.
The prison also works closely with support services. Some prisoners go on to be mentors to help others inside. And a lot of the conversations I had came back to the same thing, which was difficult pasts. For many of these men, trauma played a role in how they actually ended up here. I then had the chance to speak with a man who was serving a life sentence. He now works as a mentor on a programme called Trauma Talks. It's a 16-week course designed to help people face their issues head on.
I thought it was just another tick box exercise for the jail. Something that is a life sentence prisoner. It was going to be handy for me to have had to have done that course for getting out. Little did I realise that about halfway through the course, I would start realising just exactly where I went wrong in life. But not just understanding where you went wrong in life, why you went wrong in life, and what led you to taking drugs. My thing was, I was alcohol, cocaine. I sang in bands outside. And my thing was that any time I was faced with anything, drink. Mm. So go home, have a drink, go out, have a drink. Everything was a drink and everything was like a mask. Sometimes you see the things on the TV with the guys taking the mask off after he comes away from everyone. And that was that was a big thing for me. And then in the trauma talks, it came about halfway through it and I realised that I had so many issues that I had never dealt with. And I really wanted to deal with them and meet them head on. And that's where you have to become vulnerable and you have to become open-minded and realise that you do need help, you know, and you can't deal with everything on your own.
And what was it like finally getting help and realising that you were worthy of having it?
Being able to look yourself in the mirror is a massive thing. Understanding that you do have worth, even though you've made a mistake and you've come into prison, there's a lot more to life than, you know, than stigma, you know. And I realised that through my experiences, I could help enough out of the other guys who had maybe been through maybe stuff that maybe wasn't the same, but very similar, and led them to similar places. And for me, being able to help them and show them, and especially the word vulnerability, that it can be a strength and not a weakness, and asking for help. For me, that's massive, and for me to be able to do that in jail and give back a wee bit is means a lot to me.
So all in all, the aim here is rehabilitation in the truest sense. It's not about just serving time, but making real changes, and eventually being able to return to society with something else to offer.
On air, online, and on your smart speaker. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much to Donna Marie Doherty for that interesting insight. Okay, that's where we're going to have to leave it on the show for today. Again, wishing Paddy Keeney all the best tomorrow night. He's celebrated down in Dublin as the Donegal Person of the Year. As I said earlier on, an incredibly worthy recipient. We're going to be back on Monday. So have a great weekend, everybody, and stay safe.